We love giving you this podcast for free, and with your help we can keep it free. So how can you help the Rufus Project? Well, first up, try sharing the podcast on social media. Hey, let your friends know about the competitions we run, or even just your favourite bits. You can even review us on iTunes, or just simply give us a bit of feedback through our Facebook, Twitter, Podomatic or YouTube pages. You know, that's going to make us feel pretty good about giving you this stuff. If you do happen to have a little bit of spare cash around, why not head to therufusproject.podomatic.com and hit the donate button. We are hoping to also set up a bit of a reward scheme for those of you who are generous enough to donate. And finally, if you have a product or service you think may be of interest to the Rufus Project listeners, then please contact us at rufusreviews@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Now on with the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to geek news, movie reviews, game reviews, and upcoming events. I'm your host Trevor Holland, and we'll be joined a little bit later by our great friend Christian Fletcher for some wonderful, wonderful content. So what can you expect from this fine podcast this time around? Well, after the geek news, I have a look at a bit of a mini game for the PS4 with Infamous First Light. We don't have a movie review this time around, but we do have Christian giving us a great rundown on some of the B-grade movies of the 50s. With our redeeming features, we follow through with a bit of a B-grade sci-fi theme, but one from a more recent time. We'll let you know what great events are coming up, and we do have a new competition for you to enter. All very, very exciting. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast. Wow, what a fortnight it has been for Australian geek news. And it all circles around the current review going through with regards to Australian copyright law. And of course, every person under the sun is getting in and having their say. And what they say really seems to depend on what part of the industry they're from. Of course, you've got Village Roadshow, who came through with their submission, which had all the usual stuff. You know, they want warning notices to go without, graduated response. They don't want anyone cut off the internet. They basically say that if you have multiple violations, then your internet should be slowed down. Where they go really, really crazy is where in the opening paragraph, they actually compare downloading of copyrighted material to terrorism and pedophilia as problems on the internet. Stay classy, Village Roadshow. Stay classy. Of course, their claims, while not necessarily the terrorism and pedophilia claims, have been backed up by the likes of Foxtel. They've come quite through with a very similar submission. And the BBC has also waged in, because obviously Australia is quite high when it comes to, say, piracy of Doctor Who. And also, Australians are very popular users of VPN services to let them access content through things like Netflix and BBC iPlayer. So a feature of the BBC submission is that anyone who is a heavy internet user who makes use of a VPN service should automatically be assumed that they're up to no good, because they're hiding what they're doing, you see. Of course, there's no legitimate uses of VPNs at all, like, say, you know, just trying to do business in another country, which a lot of people do. On the other side of the coin, you have your technical companies, the guys who actually understand how the internet works. iiNet, being quite a vocal opponent of the copyright reforms proposed by the government and these various entertainment companies, of course, is very much against a three strikes policy, internet slowing, blocking of websites, all the usual guff, and is focusing very much on availability of content and affordability of content as a primary way of reducing copyright infringement. They're actually backed up by a group submission from Silicon Valley over in the US. So this is a submission which includes companies like Google, eBay, Facebook, Twitter, you know, all the ones who actually look at how the internet works and basically build their business on what people do on the net. They have a very great understanding and they're all on INET's side. So it's pretty obvious where the divide is in this argument. One side you've got the entertainment companies and the lobbyists who are lobbying the government. And on the other side, you've actually got the guys that know how the internet works. I know which side I would probably prefer to listen to, and it's not just because I'm worried about draconian measures that don't work, even though I still would hate to see money wasted on a scheme of blocking websites and introducing graduated response where anybody with even an ounce of internet knowledge is going to be able to bypass any restrictions they don't try to put in place. Wow, I was not going to rant about this. Too late, sorry, but that's the sort of argument we have here. So, again, we've got to see where this goes. One interesting side factor of this, though, is that the entertainment companies do appear to be listening. Foxtel actually announced that as part of its upcoming change in its pricing structure, it is going to look at reducing the cost of its services, which is a good thing. They're still way too expensive. There's still no way that it is comparable to, say, using Netflix through a VPN service. But look, they actually made a very slight effort, kind of like a kind of effort, but it's there, okay? Something I was not expecting to see anytime soon. And Village Roadshow has also come out saying that they are now looking at their policies. They've actually admitted that delaying the release of the Lego Movie in Australia, particularly when the Lego Movie was actually made in Australia, was a big mistake on their behalf. And they realise that now. So they now are looking at bringing content to Australia without this artificial delay that people have been complaining about for years. So that's finally gotten through. And also talking about reducing the cost of tickets to make going to the movies more affordable. So again, it does eventually get through. The gestures they're going to make, they're probably not going to be all that significant, but it's a start. And who knows, give it another 5-10 years, we might even have comparable prices and availability to what is overseas. Speaking of overseas, and something that I am quite excited about and hoping will be available for download or accessible from Australia, is BBC Radio 4 have confirmed that they are adapting the Neil Gaiman Terry Pratchett novel Good Omens into a radio series. If you've read this book before, you know this is something to be excited about. If you haven't read this book before, read the book, then you can get excited about this news with me. I am so looking forward to this. It is probably one of my favourite books of all time, and I am very much looking forward to hearing it as a radio drama. Oh, and just as a final thing, some company called Apple talked about a new phone. Apparently it's going to be bigger, it's going to be more powerful, and it's going to bring in new features that people have been accessing through third-party apps for quite some time. Seriously, I'm not excited about phone announcements anymore, because that's basically all they are now. Am I wrong? Let me know.
Miss Walker. thought you wanted to get control of your powers.
Last time I used
them. We'll start with something simple. I'll be watching your progress from up there. Please don't try anything stupid.
Well, I may have got my PS4 a bit on the late side to be able to review the launch title, Infamous Second Son, but you know what? I'm getting a chance to have a look at something very similar for this podcast. Sony decided to release a standalone DLC pack called Infamous First Light. Now, if you're not familiar with the Infamous series, it follows people known as Conduits. These guys have developed special powers. For instance, in Infamous Second Son, your main character actually has the ability to absorb the powers of other people, which makes him quite a varied protagonist and gives you a wider range of powers to play around with. And because he needs characters to absorb these powers from, he meets a few along the way. And that's where Infamous First Light gets its premise from. You see, in the main game, once you've run around Seattle, where all this is based for a bit, the main character meets another character called Fetch Walker, who has what's known as a neon power. It's quite spectacular. You can run fast, run up walls, shoot blasts of neon at people, all very groovy and quite fun to play in the main game. But remember, in the main game, you get to mix things up a bit with extra powers on top of these ones. What First Light does is take a look at the character of Fetch Walker, and you basically revisit the backstory that she gives to Delson, well, Delson kind of takes, but that's another matter, during his first encounter with her in Second Son. Told in flashback style, where Fetch is confined by the DUP, they're like the police who control the conduits in this scary, scary world of mutant powers. So you have Fetch explaining her story and her powers to the lady who's actually the big bad guy in the main game. Again, this all happens before Fetch meets Delson. Now, you don't get the full set of powers straight up. You see, using the premise that Fetch doesn't entirely trust this woman who's talking to her, she only reveals a few of her powers at a time. So by that device, you don't actually get to play with more powerful powers until further down the track, as Fetch gets more trust in this woman who says that she's trying to help her. Confused yet? Just wait. You see, trying to work out exactly who this expansion pack is aimed at is probably the same as listening to this review. If you have played the main game, then you'll probably understand a lot more of what I'm talking about. And that knowledge of the main game really helps in understanding what's going on in Infamous First Light. However, again, in the main game, you've got a much wider power set, a lot more variety, so you're essentially coming back to a more confined ability set, and it does feel like a step backwards. If you haven't played the main game, potentially you could look at this as a cheaper way to get a feel for what it might be like. The problem with approaching it that way is that a lot of the story and what happens kind of just assumes you already know what's going on in the bigger scheme of things. And that would really make playing this game a bit of a confusing mess. Speaking of the story, again, if you played the main game, you pretty much know how it's going to end up. But they do actually work on expanding Fetch's story a little bit broader, and there are some very interesting moments in there, particularly after the climax of her story in the flashbacks told in the original game. Now also, as this is a fairly inexpensive expansion, it is also quite short when you look at playing through the story mode. In an effort to expand things out, you have arenas which get introduced via the story that you can access and take on bigger challenges and various other modes in order to get a high score on the worldwide leaderboards. You also get to run around the city of Seattle wreaking a bit of havoc, with a few extra challenges thrown in that weren't in the original game. One particular is like a checkpoint race where you have to catch up with a glowing ball of energy, which gives you points to upgrade your powers. a variation on the graffiti minigame from the original game, which actually is slightly less annoying in this DLC. And of course, many a group of armed opponents to blow up as spectacularly as possible. One thing that hasn't carried over from Second Son is the morality system. Essentially, in Infamous Second Son, if you chose good actions, you got good powers, you became a hero. If you decided that instead you wanted to be destructive, take out innocents, basically just be as nasty as possible, you got bad guy powers and were considered a bit of a menace. That's all out the window. Basically, as Fetch, you do whatever. You don't actually get the choice to kill anyone, so I suppose technically it's set mostly on the good side, if you look at the Infamous morality system. However, when you go through the plot, there's an event which basically throws it out the window anyway. I guess at the end of the day, if you're someone who really liked Fetch's character from Second Son, then this probably is worth a look. Also, I guess if you're desperate or a big, big Infamous fan, really desperate for more of the Infamous action, again, you are going to find enjoyment in this expansion pack. I did like it, I did feel a bit unsatisfied by it, but it still had its fun moments. But ultimately, for what little more you get, it still doesn't feel like it's particularly good value for money. I think it is worth a play, and I think, like I said, you will find enjoyment in doing it, particularly if you also are desperate for some actual more PS4-capable content. Since the platform seems to be focusing on releasing as many indie games as possible between the big releases. So yeah, unless you're absolutely desperate for more of this type of content, probably just hold off until a PlayStation sale a bit further down the track. If you do want to see more, if you are interested in seeing how this game plays, you can also head to the Rufus Project Ustream channel. Go to Ustream and search for the Rufus Project, we're easy to find. And I did record a live stream of playing a section of the game a week or so ago. Don't forget to check out the other channels while you're there, and keep an eye on Twitter and Facebook for when we're going to do our next live stream. Woo! I put a plug in at the end of the review. Yay me!
In anticipation of the upcoming Ed Wood double feature taking place at New Globe Theatre on Tuesday the 23rd of September, I thought it was about time we looked back at some of these 50s and 60s B-grade movies. And I say B-grade in the most affectionate way. It seems to be the title that's been dubbed for these movies, and it's interesting to see their history and what they've become. It's roughly estimated between 1945 and 1964, around 500 of these features were made by such companies as American National Pictures, or AIP, and the Rank Studios. The term B-grade, or B-movie, stems from the fact that it used to play as a second feature in a double feature, usually at a place such as a drive-in. You'd have your main feature, your draw card, and a second one to sort of flesh out the night. They could give weight to the first movie, and then the second would just be filler, something churned out from the studios to fit the bill. Literally. With the advent of digital, DVD and Blu-ray now, we can revisit and actually discover these lost gems of a particular time. Whilst made in the golden age of Hollywood, they were very much the anti-studio system. They went against everything else that was actually happening in film. They were trialling new ways of doing things on the cheap, but in turn creating their own look, their own feel, and what I say, their own innocence about them. A look that we can appreciate now. The term, so bad it's good, gets thrown around a bit. But whilst these movies aren't bad, I can understand why the term's used. They worked within a budget, and the budget restraints are so visible on screen. But sometimes they manage to achieve so much more than what a studio with a $1 million budget would be able to do. Sweat and tears are literally seen on the screen. As these drive-in double features started to slowly disappear, the term B-movie then was sort of adapted to, you know, broadly inexpensive genre films, you know, exploitation, any subgenres that came out of that, cult films. But looking back at the 50s, when these movies were at their peak, science fiction and horror were seen by critics as very low budget, so they weren't very much given a review. So only the bottom of the barrel studios would dare to touch such things. Would you see 20th Century Fox releasing Attack of the Crab Monsters? And these movies were very much reflective of what was going on at that particular time. No, we weren't being invaded by aliens from outer space, or being attacked by giant leeches as we swam in a local swamp. This all came out of the fear of nuclear war, and also too the effects of radioactive fallout with their own atomic tests. So these came out of what was dubbed the atomic age. Fear and hysteria that had been generated by this were channeled into the movies they were producing. The post-World War II period seemed to almost banish the whole gothic horror, you know, you didn't have Dracula in his castle. You now had the fear of people from outer space or things enlarging to almost 100 times its size and attacking your town. It exploited the fears of the audience with low budget, but it was also sensational filmmaking. As I said, something that these big studios would never touch. Directors like Roger Corman cut his teeth on these movies. He says to this day he's made over 100 movies and never run at a loss. A lot of times too, 60% of it is the title that gets people in. Are you interested in seeing a movie called Attack of the 50-Foot Woman? Well, I believe in the early 50s you would have been, while still being scared out of your brain that this could possibly happen. Yes, it may seem far-fetched now, but this was definitely the fear of the time being translated through the film. And a lot of these movies have interesting backstories. I think of Creeping Terror from 1964, and what happened behind the scenes was almost more horrific than what you see on screen. And that is what I believe a cult film has about it. A lot of times, too, a cult film can be something that it need only have a reputation or a backstory like this. The way that the director cheated and stealed to make this movie, and then when it actually was filmed, half the soundtrack was lost, so they dubbed it over with a really deadpan narration. And I find that fascinating. But I know with situations like that, you've also got a very infamous director named Edward D. Wood Jr. He was documented in the film Ed Wood by Tim Burton from 1994. You really need to see the original movies that he made. I believe he's gone on to be the most infamous B-grade director. Unfortunately, in the early 80s, he was dubbed with the title of Worst Director of All Time, which, whilst is not a very good thing to have lumped him with, managed to give him more exposure. Titles such as Bride of the Monster and Night of the Ghouls were finally given a bit more exposure, as they hadn't been seen since the early 50s. Ed Wood filmed his opuses in run-down warehouses and roped in local friends and freaks that he knew. His most infamous work, and probably the one that most remember today, is 1959's Plan 9 from Outer Space, which has in turn been dubbed the worst film of all time. Honestly, I could find you well over 50 films that are actually worse than that. Plan 9 at least stays consistent, and it has that innocence about it.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Ed Wood put so much into this, and whilst just seeing gravestones falling over and people falling out of people's arms and actually landing on a mattress instead of a floor, you can't help but chuckle, but also appreciate that the budget restraints that Ed Wood actually had. Don't just take my word for it, though. If you want to experience these Ed Wood movies, you can on Tuesday the 23rd of September at New Globe Theatre, Fortitude Valley. We're screening the Ed Wood movies Glen or Glenda from 1953, and then Plan 9 from Outer Space, the infamous one, from 1959. Tickets are available for $10 at the door, and I look forward to seeing you there. Come along and experience some true B-grade movies and see what all the fuss is about.
What do you think will be the next obstacle the Earth people will put in our way?
Well, as long as they can think, we'll have our problems. But those whom we're using cannot think. They are the dead, brought to assimilated life by our electrode guns. You know, it's an interesting thing when you consider the Earth people who can think are so frightened by those who cannot, the dead.
Boy? Oh, boy.
Well, here we are at this podcast, Redeeming Features, and I thought I'd introduce Christian to another movie that he hadn't seen before. And this is a movie that has a bit of history. Originally a radio series, then a book, then a TV series, all with variations to the story in each different version. In fact, the radio series was repackaged as a vinyl set, a couple of double vinyl records, which again rewrote some of the script and rearranged the order of things. So when you have a movie with that sort of pedigree, it's actually a movie you can expect to be different from its source material. Just how different it was, though, I think turned out to be its undoing. If you haven't guessed, we are having a look at Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the 2005 theatrical release. And as I mentioned before, Christian had not seen it before. So, Christian, I am very interested in hearing what you thought about this movie.
I felt I was coming in so blind. I'll be honest, I didn't give it any sort of back research. I just wanted to go into it, and I've since read a couple of things about it. But I'm thinking, what kind of movie is this going to be? Look, not being into the sort of sci-fi or the, I don't know what you'd call it, the nerd culture, I don't know, it sort of felt a bit like one of those typical sort of British like Doctor Who and things like that. And not knowing anything about that sort of subgenre, I just assumed it was some Doctor Who spin-off or something to do with that. And yes, I went in completely blind, not even knowing who it was in, who was, you know, what its big budget was, whether it had had many sequels. So I was quite surprised, and to be honest, I've still got question marks pretty much all over my notes here going, what really is it all about? And my subsequent reading has led me to believe, I think it was Variety or one of those big papers actually said that it's a good movie. Well, I think even they hesitated to say even the word good, but they said reading the book would definitely enlighten people. For anyone else, it's completely lost. And I relate to that through and through, and that's probably how I went into it and how I left it. So maybe Trevor might have to enlighten me and the listeners on what is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy all about.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, from both a story point and just an origin point of view, is quite it's a story of its very, very own. I mean, the author, the late great Douglas Adams, who did have a say in the scripting of the movie as well, often explained that it came from two separate things. He was having a rather bad time hitchhiking through Europe as a young man, with his Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe in his hand, and then found himself in a field staring up at the sky, thinking that if somebody wrote the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he'd be off like a shot. Fast forward a few years, and he's actually working on writing radio plays for BBC Radio, and again, he probably wasn't in the best mood at the time. He decided to write a series of one-off episodes called The Ends of the Earth. The very first one was going to be the Earth getting destroyed for a hyperstellar bypass. And from that, he's thinking, okay, well, we need a survivor from Earth. That means we need somebody who's not from Earth to rescue him, and that person needs to have an excuse to be on the planet. And that's where he came up with the alien in this movie, Ford Prefect, being a researcher for the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who rescues his best human friend from the Earth being destroyed. And essentially, the story that goes on from there is meant to follow Arthur Dent, the main character's adventures, but also focuses around this Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is like a multimedia book. I mean, when it first came out, I guess it would have seemed quite amazing. You have this book that's all interactive and digital and can tell you what it's saying with animated illustrations. But of course, now it doesn't seem that outlandish.
Yeah, for sure. And I felt, you know, mentioning the Arthur character and the fact that he was sort of based on, I suppose, how Douglas Adams felt when he was hitchhiking. You know, he's really our relatable character in this madness.
Yeah.
You're just hoping, as he's asking questions and pondering things, you're hoping he'll give you answers very soon, because he's really, yeah, definitely the character you can relate to more than anything else. And they do show that whole backstory with him and, was it Ford? What did you say, Ford Fairlane?
Ford Prefect.
I obviously missed that. So, and you know, early on they sort of give their backstory and how he was on Earth researching. So, you know, they fill you in with that, but then it sort of goes off a bit and gets to be quite confusing. And they have a series of adventures.
indeed. A series of adventures with some rather famous names as well.
Looking in the opening credits, I was seeing all these names flying up going, oh, wow. And then you were almost getting to the spots and going, okay, when are they going to come up? Who are they going to be? And a lot of times it might have even just been a voice actor. Or at one time I picked, what's his name, Alan Rickman for one of the other characters and then realised, no, he's Marvin. So, yeah, it was really interesting trying to – and that's probably kept you guessing through the whole movie and kept you interested, I felt, who was going to play these cameos next. But they were more than cameos. A lot of them were there for quite a long time. The scene with Bill Nye was quite strange in this weird green screen scene at the end, and it went on for quite a bit, so I was surprised he wasn't even involved. But I didn't know what his caliber as an actor was at that time, so maybe they needed the work.
well, to be honest, if we start on the redeeming features, as far as I'm concerned, any time Bill Nye is involved, it's a redeeming feature. Just the way he does that, and I think as a fan going back through all the other versions of this, and with Slarty Bartpass being a very important character, love that name. I think Bill really did do that quite well. We're gonna have to address this now, and I have to come back to this. This movie is very confusing and very unbalanced. And I think it's mainly because it can't settle on who it wants to appeal to. There's so much that they've put in there for the fans, for the people that have come through from the previous versions and have a love for the previous versions. But then there is a whole pile of stuff where they've either just started on something and then just ripped a great chunk out of it, where you're going to have fans of the series going, what are you doing butchering that, to entire sections that have just been made up exclusively for the movie, some of which even just don't go anywhere. They kind of just force these bits in probably to make it more appealing to a wider audience.
And probably also to give all these big names that they've cast something to do.
Yeah, true. So that I think is the core of the problem and why this movie really didn't find an audience. It just, in trying to appeal to everyone, it's just kind of ended up being confusing.
Oh, definitely. And I don't know if it was just me, but I kind of got the vibe even in the last scene or so that they were trying to even set it up for a sequel or leave it kind of open. And I don't know, I assume that it only touched on a bit of what Douglas had written. Like there could be more movies made, even though I believe I've read that the director realised it made not enough money, so they won't be doing another one. But do you think it did have the material, even if it's confusing material?
Yeah. Again, well, the material was there, and the way they finished it did tie in very much, I guess, with how the TV series progressed. The TV show did go further into the story. I suppose if you do the comparison that way, it pretty much set up for what was the next part of the TV series, where they go off to the restaurant at the end of the universe. I mean, again, with trying to appeal to the TV audience, it was quite interesting to see in this movie that there was a lot of it which seemed like it would have been much more at home on a TV screen.
That real sort of not slapstick's not the word, but that real almost waiting for the clap and laugh track to start each little bit.
Well, even that, because you know you have your big theatrical big screen releases, and then you have stuff which is definitely more suitable to a TV screen. And I did get a big feeling that, again, from this movie, that it seems to still have a lot of that TV sensibility behind it, so it kind of didn't push the advantage through a lot of it of having that bigger screen to go to.
almost harping back to the BBC series, sci-fi serials they had back in the day, it did feel, something to be on TV, but maybe when all these big names jumped on board, they went, hang on, we can make this. I don't know, it was potentially stretched to be bigger than what it was, and I was, to be honest, looking at the clock most of the way through going, how are they going to fill out the next hour? There's another hour of this. And then I think as I went on, it got more and more confusing, and at one stage it just kind of hit me, this kind of feels like a science fiction Wizard of Oz. You've got the girl and the three guys sort of following, and I'm just kind of, okay, if I look at it that way, it's an adventure. But then I still got even more and more lost in this adventure. So, and then it is, I'm going to now sort of touch a bit earlier on my than my redeeming features, but it was very clever in the fact that it created its own world, and it was quite funny. I hope I'm not spoiling too much, but in the first few minutes, Earth encounters a kind of an end. And it was very clever how they got to that point, and how not to ruin another thing, a part that involves mice towards the end of the film, it kind of ties in a lot more about what happens with Arthur and the destruction of the Earth. But it definitely creates its own world, and I had a bit of a chuckle when they had the intergalactic news. I almost like they'd really set up their own universe, or dare I say galaxy. So that's that was clever, and it kind of was humorous in an absurd way. I don't know if I'm using the term right, but absurdist just seemed to hit to me the whole time, when things don't really make sense. Characters can be added and subtract and taken away from the scene without any sort of explanation, and it really just felt like one big in joke. And I think that was probably having not read the book. But then you're also saying too that it also would have alienated excuse the pun, a lot of the readers of the book, because it would have forfeited chunks of it just to, have a special effects scene with Stephen Fry or John Malkovich.
Yeah, actually, John Malkovich, again, there you go, there's another name that's kind of just makes an appearance. And as I was mentioning before, there are whole sections of this movie where they've just added stuff that goes nowhere, and his scene is the perfect example.
Oh, definitely.
He turns up, he this character does not exist anywhere in the previous versions, sets up a side plot involving him wanting these guys to get him a particular object from when they get to where they want to go. They find it. There's a compelling reason being half of Zaphod Beeblebrox's brain is actually still being held by John Malkovich. And it just kind of just goes, they don't go back to that. It just leaves it hanging. And I'm thinking, hang on. What?
Maybe Malkovich just really, really wanted to be in this movie. Write me a part. Maybe he was one of the backers financially.
and then that tied into the whole Trillian, played by Zooey Deschanel, being kidnapped and having to be rescued from a giant intergalactic bureaucracy, which again is in no way in the previous story. It's kind of like, well, hang on, we're making a movie, we better have a damsel in distress.
And well, I even and you got the feeling from the start when how Arthur was quite attracted to her. You're like, oh, this is a love story or a thing that's going to go somewhere. And really, they get to, I suppose they're too busy having adventures, but the whole love story just kind of then touches on it briefly at the end, and I don't know, it's almost like we felt we had to have it, and like you said, had to have a female or a damsel in distress.
Yeah, and that is it. A lot of this does seem to be that they felt they had to have it there. They may have been better off just kind of working on the material they already have rather than trying to squeeze in these extra bits.
So I suppose you could look at it as it's a BBC TV show that's been expanded for the big screen, something that was done quite a lot back in the day. And I do these screenings of these old sci-fi movies, and you can tell that they used to be on TV. They just have that feel about them. And I can definitely relate with what you're saying about that. But it's definitely very absurd.
Yeah, well, actually, speaking of absurd, that gives me the great way to bring in probably the very first redeeming feature, and I think it is the most wonderful start to this movie. Much like one movie we talked about a little while ago, this movie, even though it's not a musical, has an opening musical number. And I've got to admit, I absolutely love the So Long and Thanks for All the Fish song. Which does, it gives it that absurd start. It really is almost Python-esque,
But then at the same time, it's absurd, but it ties in with, you know, I was looking at it more like, make the most of these animals because they're not going to be here for much longer. It was almost like setting up the world as we're kind of, you know, this happy la-la world that we're living in before, you know, before what happens in the story starts to unfold. And then it's clever enough that they even then bring in, it starts the animal montage at the end as well with all the kangaroos and stuff.
Yeah.
That's almost, it does bookend the film.
It does. And then you have like a nice jazzy version of the So Long and Thanks for the Fish over the closing credits.
But that said, because I'm, you know, I am warned by Trevor, I do have to watch the film to the absolute end. And yes, if you watch through the credits, you get even more of Stephen Fry's instructional video.
And again,
where's this going?
And that again throws in something which was, I mean, that has got nothing to do with the movie you just watched, aside from a very tangential reference to a bit of dialogue. And that's a perfect example of something that's been put there purely for fans of the TV series and the book. Because, yeah, that is something which features in pretty much every version of this story.
It's so interesting. So really, it is a fanboy's wet dream, this movie.
Yeah, except
for those fans that actually know of it.
except if you are a fanboy, there's just no way you can't be disappointed. That's the problem.
Yeah, and I suppose it's sort of right in the middle of can't be please them, and it can't please the mainstream audiences. But then also, you know, I'm not a sci-fi fan myself, but just would sci-fi fans, not knowing anything about hitchhikers, go into this and still enjoy it? But then even calling it a sci-fi film is kind of not quite right.
It's a movie, and again, trying to stick with redeeming, it was so hard to just say, well, there was this cool bit, but it does seem to be full of these ideas to, I suppose, add a little extra here or throw something a little extra silly there to try to keep it moving and keep it entertaining. If you look at how the ship travels using the infinite improbability drive, which causes all sorts of bizarre things to happen to the ship, the people, and the surroundings, there's a few segments there where, like for instance, you have Ford and Arthur as a pair of conversing sofas. another one where it's all made of like wool toy animation, and you're thinking, what?
If I had to put together a montage of crazy scenes from movies, I would have to, you know, without having to play the sound, I would find heaps in that one.
Certainly, I mean, some of it is very, very clever, but it's very briefly clever. And again, there's all these like little things that do happen in the background. Like at one point, in one of these extra bits that they've shoved in there, they're trying to have the right form filled out so that they can save Trillion. And yeah. In the background, if you look carefully, you actually see the Marvin robot from the TV series, who is a very different looking beast to the Marvin robot in the movie.
Oh, that's interesting, because I got the feeling even from that scene that there's just so much to take in, like, you know, all those different characters and things like that, and I didn't notice him, so...
Yeah, it's a bit hard to tell behind all the Muppets. Because I did notice also that this is Jim Henson Productions helped with a lot of the aliens.
Ah, that explains a lot of things. So, but it's definitely definitely an interesting movie. But I don't know. Like, I know we you know, every few redeeming features we mention the word cult film, and you know, I don't know. It would have had a cult surrounding it in terms of, you know, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fans, but, you know, is it something that's endured, or did it really come and go? Do people still talk about it?
I think it really came and went. It doesn't seem to have that extra layer. I don't know, you have like the cult movies, which aren't necessarily good movies, but there's something about them, and it's something which permeates the entire movie, which kind of just, you know, draws you in, and you think, you know, the feel of the movie is something that that you love. You love diving into it and just feeling that yourself. again, because Hitchhikers is such an uneven experience, and one moment you're going, yay, they included all that stuff about the Babel fish, and then the next moment you're going, what have they done to this thing that it's kind of fits in this like little side pocket where it doesn't have that consistent feel. It doesn't have that, I think, broader appeal depending on what side of the audience or what type of fan you are, whether you be a fan of the original story, whether you're a science fiction fan, whether you're a comic adventure fan. It just kind of careens across all these things and doesn't find a home. And I think that's what stopped it from actually becoming a cult film.
Well, yeah, it could have been a direct, absolute, you know, perfect adaptation, and it would have possibly worked as a BBC TV show, you know, or TV, you know, two-part movie sort of thing, on the small screen. But then it could have gone the angle of being, you know, something that appealed to mainstream audiences. But then it sounds like it wouldn't be Hitchhikers. It wouldn't be Hitchhikers, because it sounds like, you know, not knowing the book, that whole world that they create, you know, makes sense for that.
Yeah.
So that, you know, whereas they try to make it mainstream and it just doesn't work, and yeah, it just gets lost on people. So I think possibly if they were, you know, they were better to stick to, as you've said, that, you know, subsequently with the TV shows, best to stick to that, because that's the way that it needs to be adapted. And then the audiences that want to find it will find it. Almost don't unleash it on the general public. It'll just scratch their heads. And, you know, I can't quote the box office, but I believe it didn't break even or something.
Funny enough, I may have an IMD page.
Oh, that's handy.
Very, very handy. Yes. So, I mean, it's got here, it was estimated to be a $50 million production. It grossed a whole $35,000 in its opening week.
Ooh, but, you know, usually they make up with rentals. Like, I assume this would have been one that people would have got out and had screening parties for and...
Yeah, just going through and looking at the figures, it may have got there eventually. Actually, no, it did. It did manage to make its money back. It did manage to gross over $50 million in the US.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't a complete loss. It just, I think the reason they didn't want to make more is it wasn't the success that they hoped it was going to be.
I think they really were banking on the Hitchhiker pedigree or the Hitchhiker name to bring in like that ready-made audience. But once a few people saw it and word got around, I can picture that a lot of the fans that they were after probably would have started warning other people.
Yeah, I could imagine. And word of mouth in that community can be quite quick, you know, in fandom. So, but no, I definitely think, you know, I know we're supposed to be, you know, offering redeeming features, and I suppose, I don't know if recommending's the word, but, you know, it's worth a look. Or even if it had been made in the 60s, it would have just been the perfect B-grade movie. So, Trev, we've touched on a few of your redeeming features. What makes your list? What can we recommend for people to, you know, if they want to try this? What's an incentive?
Well, I think for fans of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, playing Spot the Reference could be quite a fun little party game as a way to sit through, I suppose, some of the more puzzling parts of the movie. You know, and if you do spot this, so not so much the bigger things like Stephen Fry being the voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide itself.
Which actually sounded like you were listening to the intro to Little Big Planet, let me just say that.
Yes, well, he does have that lovely calming voice.
Yes.
And, well, Stephen Fry, I mean, there again, like Bill Nye, Stephen Fry, two redeeming features straight off the bat.
And that's, you know, well, that sums up even a lot what I'm going to say. You know, the cast, you know, that's way up there with a reason to see this movie.
Even though a lot of the big names you don't get to see. Like Alan Rickman, he's the voice of a robot. Inside the robot suit, incidentally, is Warwick Davies.
Oh, okay. good to see him getting some more work.
Yep. You've got Stephen Fry as the voice of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Helen Mirren is there, but she's the voice of a giant computer. So yeah, great names in this.
Is, you know, spot the cameo or spot the appearance, you know. And it was interesting seeing Zooey Deschanel in it because, you know, it was probably sort of at the stage when she was starting to get a bit more well-known and, you know, start to be in movies. So I was quite surprised to even see her in there. So considering she didn't sort of become a bit more famous until, you know, a few years after that. So, but, you know, definitely spotting the cameos and spotting the the actors. But and it definitely had sort of humour in its own absurd way, you know, even though I didn't quite get it, you know, most of the time. But I suppose the bits that are there and that are correct, you know, I'm sure fans of the book would quite appreciate. So, and you know, sorry, I have interrupted. Back to Trevor.
No, that's all right. Yeah,
a bit of a tangent.
Us going on a tangent? How unusual.
A tangent, though, for this movie, a tangent would be welcomed in that movie.
the movie is all tangents.
I know.
It is a movie of tangents. So yeah, I mean, so we've got, I suppose, the redeeming and the reason that a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I suppose, should watch this. Where it comes for someone who's coming in fresh, like yourself, it does kind of leave me a bit blank. I mean, there are laughs in here, and there are some very entertaining scenes, and the bit where they're zooming around, I suppose, the new Earth, sorry for the spoiler, has some quite spectacular moments, like when they visit Ayers Rock and it's not quite finished.
Yeah.
I just found that actually did tickle me pretty nicely.
Yeah, there was a few things like that, and I even felt, I for at least the first sort of 10 or 15 minutes that, there was, brief moments of time when this was going to actually go somewhere and be, the first 10 or 15 minutes is actually quite good, even though, it it's going to be confusing, but they at least give that backstory of Arthur and, what's his name again, Ford.
Yes.
I got it right. And, you know, so it gives sort of that, it sets up that, but then it just goes off into its whole, other world. But, it is still a clever, from me coming from the angle of not knowing anything, it is a clever concept that wasn't really developed more, the whole idea that aliens have been experimenting on us, not the other way around, and things like that, and the whole fact that, Earth gets destroyed at the very start. Sorry for the spoiler, but I won't say too much more. And, the only survivor is taken into space, ... So it is a clever concept, but just, you get lost in all the bit parts and, unusual segments. Because that's what it feels like. They're just going from one segment to the other.
Yeah,
yeah. All these weird, interesting set pieces.
Yeah, probably more... it probably is, just to bring the absurdist side back a bit, it kind of is more a Hitchhiker's-themed version of, say, a Monty Python sketch show, where the sketches kind of flow into one another. And again, like I said, I did get the feeling that they were trying to get, I suppose, a bit of that, like, Monty Python-style comedy feel in there. But yeah,
just fell flat a bit.
It was a valiant effort. I will give them that. It may have fallen short, but they definitely tried.
And you can see, you can see them trying on screen almost, trying so hard. And the fact that you said there was a $50 million budget, you can, I'll be honest, see it on screen. They did, there's some interesting, sequences, even though a lot of them do seem even dated. What was it, 2005 it came out, it already seems dated, some of the effects, but you can see it, where the money's gone and what they've done, but whether it could have sustained the type of film that it should have been or became is hard to know, but it exists, it's there.
It's there, so you may as well check it out.
Yeah, definitely. And I, as I said, there are, it's interesting to see what people's take would be on it, but going in completely fresh and it has made me interested, and I can understand how quirky the book is or was when it came out, and so I can appreciate that element of it. And speaking as we did about it feeling like a BBC or a British TV show, if it had come out in the 50s and 60s or even at the Monty Python era, it probably would have hit a nerve a lot more than what it did. And I think instead it fell quite flat. But if you're a fan of the book or interested in a more modern sort of sci-fi, British sci-fi film. Yeah, see it. And, you know, and to keep you going, spot the cameos. I don't know. Do it as a drinking game. Might be the way to get through it.
Yeah, probably would help to have a few drinks with this movie. you know, drink responsibly, of course.
Oh, of course. We don't want to be promoting that.
Of course. Yeah, so mainly because this gives me the perfect opportunity for a slight brag, but it does make me feel like digging out my copy of my battered old paperback copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, signed by the late great Douglas Adams, I might add.
Oh, fantastic.
And having a read of the more enjoyable version. Yeah,
the more accurate, shall we say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, like any movie adaptations, you never expect them to be super-duper accurate. And like I said at the very, very start, this is one where you can expect it to be different and to have differences. It just went a bit further afield than probably was necessary.
Yeah, than it should have, so.
Yeah, well, it's so. After all that, a very confusing movie has led to a very confusing redeeming features. Yeah. I don't know how much we redeemed.
I don't know. I'm still a very confused Christian. So,
fair enough.
But I think go in with the idea like we've said, and of looking for stars, and try to have a bit of fun with it, and see where you end up. Be interested to hear what people that have actually seen it before or after the podcast think about it.
Yep, definitely. We would love to hear your thoughts on it, either as someone who has seen it previously or if somehow we have convinced you. Again, I don't think we were very convincing this time
around. I'd love
around.
To hear if we can get someone, though, based on this.
Yes, we would love to hear your thoughts and what you thought of us for telling you this movie existed. So, yeah, and certainly if you have any movies that you think may challenge us even further, then let us know. We're always looking for more bad movies to revisit with a bit of a fresh look.
Yeah, definitely.
Fantastic. Okay, well, thank you very much, Christian. As always, I love doing this segment.
Yeah, thank you, Trevor. I love doing the segment and hearing about what the next movie's going to be. But have a little bit of fear as well before the title is revealed.
Yes, indeed. Definitely let us know, and let's see what we can dig up for next time.
Cool. Well, thank you, Trevor.
Thank you, Christian.
The world's about to be destroyed. There's no point getting all annoyed.
Lie back and let the planet dissolve. Despite those nets of tuna freaks, we thought that most of you were sweet, especially tiny tots and your pregnant women. So long, so long, so long, so long, so long.
So long, so long, so long, so long, so long.
So long, so long, and thanks for all the fish.
September 2014 is jam-packed with lots of exciting movie and music events happening around town. I'm really excited to be running two special anniversary events coming up next week. We have Die Hard on Tuesday the 16th of September, which is screening for its 25th anniversary. It's time to revisit the original classic starring Bruce Willis on the big screen at Chanel Theatre on Tuesday the 16th of September at 7 p.m. Tickets are $10 available at the door. The following night, we're doing a special 15th anniversary screening of the Brad Pitt Edward Norton film Fight Club. Based on the cult book and also co-starring Helena Bonham Carter, Fight Club from 1999 is definitely one to revisit with a group of friends and to see on the big screen. This is happening at New Globe Theatre on Wednesday the 17th of September at 6:30 p.m. Tickets are $10 at the door. The infamous Rocky Horror Picture Show Floor Show is back on Friday the 19th of September. See the 1975 movie musical come to life as the movie screens, and live performers will bring to life your favourite characters and scenes and numbers from the movie. Tickets are available at the door for $15 per person. This is a 15-plus event. Get your friends together, snap on those suspenders, and get ready to do the time warp again. This will be celebrating 14 years of Cards for Sorrow, who have been bringing the film to life at venues around Brisbane since 2000. To keep the 70s vibe going, how about the 70s versus 80s party at Port Office Hotel on Saturday the 20th of September? With 20 years of classic hits, we ask patrons to choose. Are you Team 70s or Team 80s? With dueling DJs, dance floor, dance off, and costume prizes, from 7 till 11, the Port Office Hotel will be taken over by the best in 70s and 80s music. So go on, choose your side, and we'll see you on the 20th of September. Tragic Tuesdays at New Globe Theatre continues September 23rd with a classic Ed Wood double feature. The infamously dubbed worst director of all time is getting a bit of a retrospective with two of his most infamous movies, Glen or Glenda from 1953 and the film also dubbed possibly the worst movie of all time, Plan 9 from Outer Space from 1959. Wear your alfoil on your heads, get ready to wave your paper plates, and come along and see what a 50s B-grade movie double feature is all about. This starts off at 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday the 23rd of September, and tickets are $10 at the door, valid for both movies. The September school holidays are fast upon us. Looking for something you can take the kids to, but also enjoy yourself? The New Globe Theatre in Fortitude Valley is screening three classic family kids movies. Two of them Disney, Little Mermaid on Saturday the 27th of September at 3 p.m. and on Wednesday the 1st of October, The Lion King at 6:30 p.m. But if you'd prefer a bit of 80s cult or Ozploitation, how about the Nicole Kidman starring BMX Bandits from 1983? That's screening on Sunday the 28th at 3 p.m. Tickets are $10 at the door for these school holiday movies. For more information about all my upcoming events, visit www.christianfletcher.com and follow me on Facebook. I look forward to seeing you at a cinema very soon.
It's competition time. Woohoo! We are announcing a new competition this time round, but you still have time to enter our Rocky Horror competition. Just to remind you, that is a competition for a double pass to see Rocky Horror Picture Show at the Chanel Cinema at University of Queensland St. Lucia on September 19 with an accompanying floor show by the infamous floor show cast, Cards for Sorrow. You may have heard us mention them a few times before on the podcast. To win this, you simply need to leave the comment Janet on any of the appropriate contact points. But more importantly, now it's time to go on to the new competition. You may have heard Christian announce Tragic Tuesdays, a new ongoing feature at the New Globe Theatre on Brunswick Street in Fortitude Valley, Brisbane, Queensland. And we actually have a double pass to an upcoming special event that was discussed a little earlier on in this very, very podcast. Yep, we have a double pass to the Ed Wood double feature on the 23rd of September. So again, what that gets you is a double pass to see the infamous Glen or Glenda and the even more infamous, some would say one of the most infamous movies of all time, Plan 9 from Outer Space, both on the big screen. This also includes free popcorn, so even if you don't enjoy the movies, you get a free bag of popcorn. Woo! So, how can you win this fantastically tragic prize? Well, really, there's only one code word we can use for this, and it's a tribute to the very famous actor who appeared in Plan 9 from Outer Space. So if you want to win this very special double pass, leave the comment Lugosi in any of the usual places. Now, we'll go through all our contact details at the end of the podcast very, very soon. So definitely get your entries in. We would love to see you at one of these great events. Thank you so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. Now, if you do want to enter any of our competitions, or if you have any feedback, suggestions, or requests, then you can contact us via The Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook. We have a YouTube and a Ustream channel, and you can also visit our homepage at therufusproject.podomatic.com. If you want to be a bit more private with your correspondence, you can also send us an email to rufusreviews@gmail.com. We're also very interested in hearing from anybody who feels that they or something they're doing would be suitable for our local wildlife section. Now, do remember also that on the internet, we're all local, so it doesn't need to be Brisbane or Australia-based. We would really love to hear from anybody out there who would like to be featured. Also, don't forget that if you have a sign-out for the podcast, also get that through to us. And I'll be happy to say pretty much whatever you want me to say at the end of this podcast. I do ask that it be kept family-friendly, though. With that in mind, until next time, Cookie Monster. Thanks, Mackie. That's a great one. Oh, boy. See you next time. You know, all this copyright and anti-piracy talk really just makes me think of one thing, one wonderful, wonderful thing. So to round this out, I'm not going to make a sarcastic comment myself. I'm just going to leave this nice little segment from the classic show, The IT Crowd, for you to listen to, and you'll get what I mean.
You wouldn't steal a handbag. You wouldn't steal a car. You wouldn't steal a baby. You wouldn't shoot a policeman and then steal his helmet. You wouldn't go to the toilet in his helmet and then send it to the policeman's grieving widow and then steal it again. Downloading films is stealing. If you do it, you will face the consequences.
These anti-piracy ads are getting really mean.